We're into the fifth trumpet judgment. And as we've seen going through these judgments, the seal judgments, the trumpet judgments, how there tends to be an escalation, and they're telescopic. The seal judgment, the seventh seal judgment, is the trumpet judgments. The seventh seal contains all the rest of the judgments that are going to be poured out. And when the seventh seal is broken, that's when the trumpet judgments begin. And we saw that the first four trumpet judgments were, in chapter 8, were judgments on the ecology, on the environment. We saw on the first trumpet how the third of the earth, a third of the trees, all the green grass was burned up. In other words, there's a partial judgment. And remember, we said that is there a contradiction where it says here all the green grass is burned up, but yet under the fifth trumpet, the locusts are told not to harm the green grass. Well, again, it's just things like these that unbelievers or skeptics will throw in to try to confuse. And the answers are always so simple. You know, grass grows back. You know, grass can be scorched and burned over, but it always grows back. And so the first judgment was against the plant life. The second trumpet was the sea and the creatures in the sea. And a third of the sea was turned to blood. A third of the creatures in the sea died. And again, it's a partial judgment. It's partial devastation. It's not a total devastation yet. It's going to get worse. And then the third trumpet, where we saw the fresh water is affected. And then in the fourth trumpet, the sun, the moon, and the stars. And even going back a little bit farther, we saw that in chapter 7, before the seventh seal was broken, there was an angel, four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, so that no wind should blow on the earth or on the sea or on any tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun, having the seal of the living God. And he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea. Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the bondservants of our God. So there was an interruption between the sixth and seventh seal. And the interruption allowed the sealing of the 144,000. And these four angels were told not to harm the earth, the sea, or the trees. Well, now that that interruption is over, the seventh seal is broken. And what are the first four trumpet judgments? They're on the earth, the sea, the trees, the grass, the ecology. So these four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth are turned loose now. They're turned loose in the first four trumpet judgments. But then, now we get to the fifth trumpet, which is the first of the woes pronounced in chapter 8, verse 13. I looked and heard an eagle flying in mid-heaven saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet." So there's three trumpets left, the fifth, the sixth, and the seventh trumpet. Each one is a woe. As we see in verse 12 of chapter 9, the first woe is past. Behold, two woes are still coming after these. So the fifth trumpet is the first woe. And as we are going to get along in this a little bit further, we're going to see that just as there was a delay between the sixth seal and the seventh seal, there's going to be a delay. There was two events that delayed the opening of the seventh seal. The first event was the sealing of the 144,000. And then in verse 9 of chapter 7 began the vision of the great multitude of Jews and Gentiles in heaven. Those who have been martyred for the faith. The same thing is going to happen after the sixth trumpet at the end of chapter 9 and chapter 10. There's one event, the opening of the little book. And then in chapter 11, there's the two witnesses. And then the seventh trumpet is blown. So, we also saw that in these first four trumpets, the effect on man was indirect. It was targeted primarily at the cosmos, the sun, the moon, the stars, the earth, the fresh water, the salt water, the creatures in the sea. Now these fifth and sixth trumpet are going to have a direct effect on man. Man is the direct target of these next judgments. And just to back this up a little bit with Old Testament prophecy, it's not like any of this is new news. This has been prophesied over and over and over again through the Old Testament. And just to give a little sampling, I'm just going to run through a few passages here. You can turn to them if you want, or you can just listen. Amos chapter 9, 11 through 15. There's a promise of restoration, five promises of restoration for the nation of Israel. In that day, I will, notice as I read through this the number I will statements, I will raise up the fallen booth of David and wall up its breaches. I will also raise up its ruins and rebuild it in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom. All the nations who are called by my name, declares the Lord who does this. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when the plowman will overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes whom who sows seed, when the mountains will drip sweet wine, and all the hills will be dissolved. Also I will restore the captivity of my people Israel. They will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will also plant vineyards and drink their wine and make gardens and eat their fruit. I will also plant them on their land, and they will not again be rooted out from their land which I have given them, says the Lord your God. So again, here's a promise of future restoration, but that's coming at the end. That's coming at the end of Revelation. There's a process that has to be gone through before we get there, and that's one of judgment. Isaiah chapter 13, Isaiah writes in verse 9 and following, Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation, and he will exterminate its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises, and the moon will not shed its light. Thus I will punish the world for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud, and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Therefore I shall make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place at the fury of the Lord of hosts in the day of His burning anger. Isaiah 24. Beginning in verse 1. Behold, the Lord lays the earth waste, devastates it, distorts its surface, and scatters its inhabitants. And the people will be like the priest, the servant like his master, the maid like her mistress, the buyer like the seller, the lender like the borrower, the creditor like the debtor. The earth will be completely laid waste and completely despoiled, for the Lord has spoken His word. The earth mourns and withers. The world fades and withers. The exalted of the people of the earth fade away. The earth is also polluted by its inhabitants, for they transgressed laws, violated statutes, broke the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are held guilty. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. It's the earth that is being judged. Not just Israel, not just the Middle East, the earth, all of mankind, rebellious. And I could go on. There's Zephaniah 3:8 and following, Zephaniah 1:14-18, Haggai 2:20-22. I'm not going to take the time to go through all those, but just over and over again through the Old Testament, we see these prophecies of a coming, of a future wrath of God coming not just on the nation of Israel for their disobedience and covenant disobedience, but upon the entire earth. And the judgment is on rebellious mankind, and Israel's included in this. But there's a purpose for Israel. For Israel, this is a purging, this is a cleansing, to make them fit to go into the millennial kingdom where they will receive all the covenant promises that were promised to them. But before they can receive them, they have to be made fit. They have to be brought in and purged and cleansed. And as Zechariah 13 tells us, a third of the nation of Israel is going to perish during this time. So we come to the fifth trumpet, this first woe. Let me just read through verse 12. That's as far as we're going to get tonight. And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the bottomless pit was given to him. And he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke went up out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke of the pit. And out of the smoke came forth locusts upon the earth, and power was given them, as the scorpions of the earth have power. And they were told that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, nor any green thing, nor any tree, but only the men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. And they were not permitted to kill anyone, but to torment for 5 months. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings a man. And in those days men will seek death and will not find it. And they will long to die, and death flees from them. And the appearance of the locusts was like horses prepared for battle, and on their heads, as it were, crowns like gold, and their faces were like the faces of men. And they had hair like the hair of women, and their teeth were like the teeth of lions, and they had breastplates like breastplates of iron. And the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots, of many horses rushing to battle. And they have tails like scorpions and stings, and in their tails is their power to hurt men for 5 months. They have as king over them the angel of the abyss. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in the Greek he has the name Apollyon. The first woe is past. Behold, two woes are still coming after these things. So as we see the first woe here, who is this woe falling on? Well, we see it in chapter 8, verse 13, right? Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth. And I mentioned this before, but just that phrase, those who dwell on the earth. When we find that in Revelation, and in the New Testament, we only find that phrase in Revelation with one exception, and that's in Luke 21:35, where Jesus talks about the judgment that's coming upon all those who dwell on the earth. But when it's referring to those who dwell on the earth, it's referring to unbelievers, it's referring to the unregenerate, it's referring to those who are in rebellion against God. It's used 8 times in the New Testament, and 7 of them are found in Revelation. So this judgment is coming on those who dwell on the earth. God knows how to make a distinction between His people and the unrighteous. Just like He did in Egypt. When the plagues fell on Egypt, everything was just fine in the land of Goshen. The cattle weren't affected over there. The gnats didn't affect there. The darkness wasn't there. God knows how to distinguish between His people and those who are not His people. So it's coming upon those who dwell on the earth, the unregenerate. Now this section, verses 1 through 12, can really be divided into 2 parts. Verses 1 through 6, we can call it the affliction of the locusts, and then in 7 through 12 is the appearance or the description of the locusts, what they looked like. So you have the affliction and the appearance of the locusts. So in verse 1, John sees, the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven. Well, what is this? What is this star from heaven? Or more appropriately, who is this star from heaven? A star from heaven which had fallen to the earth. It had already fallen. John didn't see it fall. It was already on earth. That's what the tense tells us in the Greek. Well, this is a person. It's not a literal star. The key of the bottomless pit was given to him. So we're talking about a person here, not a star. Now the question is, who is this person? And by whom was the key given? Well, again, in Revelation, when we see something being given, it's typically always God doing the giving. Just like when the first 4 angels, they're given trumpets. Who gave them to them? God gave them to them. God is the one giving the key of the bottomless pit was given to him. So the question is, who is this that has fallen from heaven. What is this person? This, is it human? Some people try to spiritualize it, try to make it be some type of human leader in the history, in the past. But no human leader fell from heaven. This is a supernatural being that we're talking about here, not a human being. Who is it? Is it Satan? Is it a fallen angel? Some people speculate, yes, because the word is he fell from heaven. But the word fallen can just mean he descended from heaven. Well, we just ask, what all the judgments that have been carried out so far in the book of Revelation have been carried out by who? By what? By angels, heavenly angels, angelic, and unfallen angels. And so we see that this angel to whom the key of the bottomless pit was given, this person, this isn't Satan. This isn't an unfallen, or this isn't a fallen angel. This is more than likely, the best would be an unfallen angel. We see this in chapter 20, even in verse 1. I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. You know, and this angel is coming to bind Satan and throw him into the abyss. And he's the one who had the key. So I think it's safe to identify this being that's fallen from heaven, coming down, that has the key to the bottomless pit, is an angel, an unfallen angel, exercising, playing his part in God's judgment upon rebellious mankind. And he was given the key of the bottomless pit. Now, what is the bottomless pit? Again, it's a lot of speculation. Is it hell? Well, probably not, because hell is never defined as a bottomless pit. Hell is defined as a lake of fire. The word bottomless here is the Greek word abusos, or where we get our word abyss. You know, it's the picture of a bottomless shaft, a well. It's not the lake of fire. So what is it? I think we get a clue from Luke chapter 8, verse 31. If you remember, in this passage, this is where Jesus goes into the country of the Gerasenes, comes upon a demoniac, asks him, "What is your name?" And he says, "My name is Legion, for we are many," right? And what were these demons doing? Verse 31, they were entreating him, Jesus, not to command them to depart into the abyss. Same word, abusos, into the abyss. 1 Peter 3:19 tells us of demons who are imprisoned. Chapter 20, verse 1 through 3, shows us that Satan is thrown in where? He's thrown into the abyss. And he's shut up for 1,000 years. But then in verse 10 of chapter 20, the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone. So there's a difference between the lake of fire and brimstone, hell, and the abyss. What is the abyss? It just seems to be a place of confinement until the final judgment. Jude's little epistle. Well, these new Bibles, the pages want to stick together on them all the time. Somebody gets there before I do, read it. Because my pages do not want to come apart. Jude 6 and 7. There we go. I made it. And angels who did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode, he is kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. This is the abyss. It's a place of being kept in eternal judgment, being kept in darkness until the judgment of the great day. This is the abyss that has been opened up here in Revelation. It's not hell. It's just a place of confinement until the final judgment. And so this angel from heaven, verse 2, he opened the bottomless pit. Smoke went up out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke of it. Again, this is just literal smoke. We don't have to spiritualize and say this is the influence of Satan permeating the world like some people have. It's literal smoke. Smoke is often connected with judgment, especially in the Old Testament, God's judgment. The only time the term, the word smoke, is used outside of the book of Revelation is in Acts 2:19, where Peter is quoting the apostle or the prophet Joel concerning the day of wrath and the day of the Lord being a day of darkness and smoke. But this smoke rises up, it blocks the sun, it pollutes the air. And we've seen news footage of this, just of volcanoes that spew so much ash and smoke and fumes into the air that it totally blocks out the sun. And of course, it pollutes the air. Well, this is what we're seeing here. It's like the smoke of a great furnace, a smelting furnace. And out of the smoke came forth locusts upon the earth. And there are so many questions to answer in this passage. Locusts, what are they? What are these locusts? Again, we've had speculation beyond speculation. Everything from, you know, real, literal locusts to helicopters. You know, these are helicopters. I've even heard people do that. It's just, go off into flights of fancy when you get outside the text, what the text says. These locusts come upon the earth. Are they literal locusts? Locusts? Well, they don't do what literal locusts do. What do literal locusts eat? Vegetation. But these locusts have been commanded in verse 4, not to hurt the grass of the earth, any green thing or any tree. So, are they literal locusts? Probably not, no. Are they human armies? Armies, which is what some people have said, just a massive human army coming in. Well, a human army is not going to rise up from the abyss. This ought to be a big key and clear indicator of what these locusts are. If they're coming out of the abyss, the place where demonic beings have been consigned until the day of judgment. These are demonic beings. These are fallen angels. And again, fallen angels can inhabit and take many forms. Later on in Revelation, we're going to see they take the form of frogs. When Jesus cast the demons out of the man who was possessed with a legion, what did they go into? They went into swine, into pigs. So they can take many forms and assume different forms. Paul tells us they masquerade as angels of light. So power was given to them. By who? God. As scorpions of the earth have power. Now, we're going to see John using a lot of descriptive language in this passage. And by descriptive language, I mean words like as, like. He's not saying they are like this. Though they are this, but he's saying they are like this. So these scorpions, these locusts, power was given them as scorpions of the earth have power. In other words, their power, what the pain they're going to be afflicting, is likened to the pain of a scorpion sting. I did a little research on I've never been stung by a scorpion. I don't know if anybody here has. So I did a little research on what it's like to be stung by a scorpion. And it depends on the type. The scorpion has a neurotoxin. The most toxic scorpion in America is found in Arizona. It's an Arizona bark scorpion. And they can inflict a nasty sting. Some are actually can be fatal to man, especially to Australia. Scorpion, or what's called the yellow scorpion, or the death stalker. But what's more important is the pain that these scorpions inflict. Apparently, it's one of the most painful stings. Some scorpions, the sting is just like a bee sting, but there's some that are extremely painful. There's immediate pain, a burning sensation. It's sensitive to the touch. It produces sweating, heart palpitations, a rise in blood pressure, There's nausea, vomiting, fever. You can even develop into coma, go into convulsions and foaming at the mouth, and eventually get fluid in the lungs. So it can be extremely serious, and it's extremely painful, and the pain can last for up to a week. But here we have these demonic beings who are taking the form of these locust-like creatures, and they're given power as scorpions of the earth have power. But there's a limitation imposed on them in verse 4. There's limitations. They were told they should not hurt the grass of the earth, any green thing, any tree. Only the men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. God knows how to distinguish between those who are His and those who are not. God has set aside these 144,000 special witnesses from the 12 tribes of Israel. But now they are set aside. They're excluded from this, from the direct effect of this judgment. And again, it's just showing us God sovereignly controls His judgments. Nothing is outside the sphere and control of God. When God executes a judgment on the earth, every aspect of the judgment is under His control. Even who is affected by that judgment and the degree to which they are affected, all is under God's sovereign control. We're told in verse 4, they were told they should not hurt the grass of the earth. Told by who? By God. You know, these are demonic beings. But demonic beings cannot do anything outside the scope of what God allows them to do. They aren't out there acting independently. When so much bad theology is out there, especially within the charismatic movement, on demonology, as though there's a devil behind every bush, and every sin is because the devil made me do it. And they've got these demons running around up there, acting independently, and looking for people that they can just trip up. That's not the way they work. They cannot do that. They do not act independently. They can't do anything outside of what God has ordained for them to do. God controls His judgments. This is the way it's always been. We've just, again, been reading through Jeremiah. And I was struck in Jeremiah 43, verse 10 and 11. God is, through Jeremiah, has told the remnant to stay in Jerusalem and not flee to Egypt, and that He would take care of them. But they refuse and say, no, we're going to go to Egypt anyway. So in verse 10 and 11, God says to them, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I am going to send and get Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and I'm going to set his throne right over these stones that I have hidden, and he will spread his canopy over them. I will also come and strike the land of Egypt. Those who are meant for death will be given over to death, those for captivity to captivity, and those for the sword to the sword. So you try to run away from Egypt, from Nebuchadnezzar into Egypt, it's not going to work because I'm going to get him and I'm going to bring him there. God is sovereign over it all. Every bit of it, over His judgment, over His blessings, everything. And again, it just shows us this is not the wrath of man. This is not the wrath of Satan, as some eschatological end-time views want to say. This is God's wrath. God's wrath on a rebellious earth. But what is kind of ironic here, as we're seeing, is we got rebels being afflicted by rebels. You know, you've got the rebellious fallen angels afflicting rebellious mankind. You'd think these would form an alliance. But no, you have rebels afflicting rebels. And it just shows the irrational, illogical nature of evil. Sin is irrational. Sin is illogical. It makes no sense to violate God's statutes. It makes no sense to go against God's word, because the wages of sin is death. It makes no sense, but all sin is illogical, all sin is irrational, and we just see it being played out here. So God exempts those who have been sealed on their foreheads. These are off limits. And they don't get the direct effects of the judgment. Verse 5, they were not permitted to kill anyone. Now, is that good or is that bad? Well, from what we're going to see, according to the people that are left on earth or they're being afflicted by this judgment, that's probably pretty bad because they're going to be longing to die, but they're not allowed to kill anyone, but to torment. The word literally means torture, to torture them for 5 months. Again, it's literal 5 months. And this just really coincides with the natural locust season. The natural locust season was from May to September. That's when locusts would come in and do their dirty work and strip the vegetation if it was a bad locust plague. But they were sent to torment, to torture. And their torment was like the torment of scorpions when it stings a man. They're just there to inflict as much misery on mankind as they possibly can. In verse 6, and in those days, men will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die, and death flees from them. I mean, this should have brought about repentance, this judgment, but it doesn't. But it only brings about a desire to escape it, to get out from under it. Death was preferable to what they were going through. And death is the only escape. They are actively, constantly seeking death. But they will not find it. Oumei, the strongest negation in the Greek. They will not, under any circumstances, ever be able to find it. They can't get it. And they will long to die. Epithumia, strong. Strong desire to die. This is going to be what they're constantly seeking, preoccupied with death. But it's not only going to be impossible for them to die, but death flees from them. It runs away from those who are pursuing death. They're not only not going to be able to find it, but if they did find it, it's going to flee from them. They're not going to be able to die. They won't be able to take their own life. Now, just consider for a minute here. This is on earth. This is torment on earth by demonic beings. And the pain that these people are experiencing is so excruciating, all they want to do is die to escape it. Now, consider hell. In hell, the torment will be worse. Because the people in hell are going to be resurrected beings. They will be resurrected in resurrected bodies. A physical body can only withstand so much pain and torture and torment before it eventually gives away. A resurrected body, it could withstand limitless. The bodies, the resurrected people in hell are going to be under the eternal wrath of God. Here they seek death as an escape. Hell, there is no escape. There's no chance, no hope of ever having the pain alleviated, of reduced, of going away, of having a moment's reprieve from the intensity of it. It's constant hell under the wrath of God. Constant. This is what John is trying to communicate here. People, this is what you're going to go through. This is what he's communicating to the seven churches. Either you keep persevering in where you are, or you need to repent of these things I told you need to repent of. Because if you don't, and you don't persevere, this is what you have to expect to go through. And if you're not going to go through this because you are persevering and you have repented, you need to be motivated and out there telling people, you don't want to go through this. This is a reality. This is coming. And if you think this is bad, hell is infinitely worse. Infinitely worse. So now John describes the appearance of these locusts. He tells us the affliction, what's going to happen when they're here. And now there's the appearance. And again, here's where John just really gets into the descriptive language. He uses the word as or like over 9 times to describe these locusts. It's what we call a simile. You know, it was like this or it was like that. And John is just using terms, using descriptions that are familiar to him. If this happened in our day and we saw what John saw, we would probably use different terminology to describe what we were seeing. You know, and John in verse 9 says that the sound of their wings were like the sound of chariots of many horses rushing to battle. We might say it sounded like an airplane taking off or a train engine, whatever. But John here is using language, using descriptions of things that he was familiar with. And so he tells us in verse 7, the appearance of the locusts was like horses prepared for battle, on their heads, as it were, crowns like gold. Something like crowns. Stephanos is the Greek word. It's the victor's crown. Again, just showing that these beings are going to be victorious for the amount of time that they've been given. They're going to have success for 5 months. They have faces of men or like men. Again, showing intelligence. These aren't bugs. These are intelligent, demonic beings. And they had hair like women. In other words, it's long hair. It's on their head, not on their body. Now, you might have some hairy women, but that's not what we're talking about here. It's long hair on the head, not on the body. Teeth of lions. But these locusts don't use their teeth. They use their tails, right? Their power is in their tail. But it's just this ferocious image. In verse 9, they had breastplates, like breastplates of iron. The word is thorax. You know, if you're a thoracic surgeon, that means you confine your surgery to the from the shoulders to the waist. It's this part. So they have breastplates of iron, just showing their invincibility. They're invincible during this time. And the sound of their wings is like the sound of chariots. Their wings, they're mobile. They can go when and where they please. And it was like the sound of chariots, many horses rushing to battle. In other words, just mighty, powerful, invincible. This is what John is depicting here. And their tail is the real source of their power. All this other stuff is terrible looking. But in verse 10 he says, and they have tails like scorpions and stings. And in their tails is their power to hurt men for 5 months. Again, just reiterating what he said up in verse 5. There it was told he was to torment for 5 months. Here it's to hurt for 5 months. Just hurting so bad, all you want to do is die. But you can't. You can't. Now, the thing that distinguishes these, especially from on regular locusts, and shows that there's some type of demonic being, these have a leader. Verse 11, they have his king over them, the angel of the abyss. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon. In the Greek, he has the name Apollyon. So here we have a leader, and this leader has a name. Well, who is he? Well, we have his name, Abaddon, Apollyon. One's in Hebrew, one's in Greek. They both mean destroyer. And why does he give us two names? Because both groups of people are affected, the Hebrew and the Greek, the Gentile. They're both affected by this being. Well, who is he? Is he Satan? No, Satan's not in the abyss until chapter 20, verse 1 through 3, right? When he's bound and thrown into the abyss. Satan is the prince of the power of the air. Satan is roaming the earth. You know, he prowls about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. James says we're to resist the devil and he will flee from you. Well, if he's bound in the abyss, why do we have to resist him? Ephesians 6:12 tells us that we war against the domain or the domain is a heavenly domain. It's powers of the heavens that we war against. But this is a king. This king over them is the angel of the abyss, the destroyer. So who is he? He's just some unknown fallen angel. And whoever he is, he was the head of all the demons that were confined in the abyss waiting final judgment. But now they're released. You know, biblical names were more than just monikers, more than just a designation. Biblical names denoted a person's character. Jacob was named Jacob because it means one who supplants. That's why when he robbed Esau of his birthright, Esau said, "Rightly is he named Jacob. Twice he supplanted me now of my birthright." So it just means one who supplants. So a name told something about the person's character. And this is a destroyer. This is what they're doing. This is what those under his leadership are doing. They're going out inflicting as much misery as they possibly can on unregenerate, rebellious mankind. And then John tells us, verse 12, the first woe is past. Not literally, it hasn't happened yet, but it will be past in the future when John is seeing this. But just because this is past doesn't mean there's any relief in sight, because two woes are still coming after these things. Again, just the term there, after these things, shows us that these are consecutive. They're not concurrent. The day of the Lord is a period of time. It's not an event. It's not a moment. It's a period of time. And they run consecutively. One thing happens, then another thing happens, then another. After that, another thing. After that, another. There's one after the other. It's not just one explosive event. This is going to be a terrible, terrible time to be alive. And the future of mankind, apart from Jesus Christ, is not very rosy in this life or the next life. That's why when we go through this, when we read this, yeah, the end is wonderful when we see the return of Christ and the setting up of the millennial kingdom and the new Jerusalem and the new heavens and the new earth and all the glorious that await us. But in the interim, there's this. And we really don't want people to go through this. And that's why John wrote this, was motivation for evangelism. Motivation to get out there, to live the life that God has called you to live, to be salt, to be light, and to turn people with the gospel, to just give them the gospel, to warn them. This is part of the gospel. Warning of future judgment is part of the gospel. So often the gospel that we hear today is just believe in Jesus and everything will be wonderful. But this is part of the gospel, warning of future judgment. And we can't minimize the reality of hell. We got people today that are denying the reality of hell. One of the most popular is Rob Bell out there now with his book, Love Wins. And it's been influencing a lot of people. And they deny the reality of hell. I think A.W. Tozer calls it that the denial of hell, the denial of the justice of God, has been an opiate for the masses to allow them to think that God is just going to wink at their sin. Everybody's going to go to heaven. And that's not true. It's not true. It's not the teaching of the Bible. So we need to be motivated as we read these and we see what the end times are going to be like. It should motivate us. Give us compassion to reach out to others and motivate us to live the life that God has called us to live. Any questions, comments?